Okay, thank you very much.
That was Frank Bryan, professor of political science at the University of Vermont and author of Real Democracy, speaking at the first statewide convention on Vermont secession held last Friday in Montpelier.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop begins to fall, and it turns into a trickle, and the trickles flow down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the waters flow. Watch the current then become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder, growing thunder, now the river.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We continue as Thomas Naylor introduces the keynote speaker.
It wasn't by chance that the title of that talk was The View from Big Hollow Road in Starksboro, Vermont. Late last August, I picked up a copy of The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler and finished it like about 7:15 a.m. one morning, and I said to myself, I've got to meet this guy. And after reading what he had to say about Saratoga Springs, New York, he sang like a guy who probably had a listed telephone number. And I called him up, and lo and behold, he did have a listed telephone number. We talked for about an hour. And by sheer luck, he happened to be scheduled to speak in Montpelier at 4 p.m. today, the 28th of October, across the street at the Capitol Plaza Hotel. The Long Emergency never mentions the word secession, even though this is a conference on secession. To the best of my knowledge, the state of Vermont is not mentioned. It's possible, but if it's in there, I didn't see it. Yet, this man may have written what is essentially the fundamental rationale underlying our movement. That's why I invited him to be the keynote speaker. He was born in New York City, lives in Saratoga Springs. He's published 9 novels. More recently, he's published 3 nonfiction works, The Geography of Nowhere, Home from Nowhere, and The City in Mind, and then most recently, The Long Emergency. He's a former editor of Rolling Stones. He's written for Atlantic Monthly and the New York Times Magazine, among many other places. It's a great pleasure to welcome James Howard Kunstler.
It's a pleasure to be here in this beautiful chamber and to be in Vermont. We're next-door neighbors, of course. I'm a New Yorker. And I'm sorry, I apologize for being one. And I'm an outsider here, I realize that. I'm going to make an effort to speak clearly, perhaps a little too clearly, super clearly, for the benefit of the people in the back. I was standing in the back earlier, and I realize the acoustics in this room are a little bit strange. So if I sound a little artificial to those of you in the front, bear with me and forgive me. When we think about the destiny of our land, There are a few questions we might ask. What do we mean by our land? What has been holding it together? Who are we? And who will we become? If that's for me, I'm not here. Who will we become? For about 210 years, we've been a federal democratic republic composed of more than a few states, eventually adding up to 50. At times, the citizen's identity has shifted from allegiance to a particular state to the republic as a whole, as when Robert E. Lee, for instance, famously declared that he was first a citizen of Virginia. Lately, the tendency has been for citizens to think of themselves first as Americans and secondarily as New Yorkers or Virginians or Vermonters. What has held us together, at least since the convulsion of the Civil War, is a common culture and especially the common enterprise of a great industrial economy. For much of our history, including the first half of the 20th century, we were a resourceful, adaptive, generous, forward-looking, brave people who believed in earnest effort, who occupied a beautiful landscape full of beautiful places, worth caring about and worth defending. Since then, lost in raptures of easy motoring, fried food, incessant infotainment, and desperate money grubbing, we became a nation of overfed clowns who believed that it was possible to get something for nothing, who ravaged the landscape in an orgy of wanton carelessness, who believed they were entitled to lives of everlasting comfort and convenience, no matter what, and expected the rest of the world to pay for it. We even elected a vice president who declared that this American way of life was non-negotiable. We now face the most serious challenge to our collective identity, our economy, our culture, and security since the Civil War. The end of the cheap fossil fuel era will change everything about how we live in this country. It will challenge all of our assumptions. It will compel us to do things differently, whether we like it or not. We are at or near the all-time maximum global oil production peak. We do not have to run out of oil to find ourselves in trouble. When the world demand for oil exceeds the world's capacity to produce oil, all the complex systems we depend on will destabilize. Everything from national chain retail to the Archer, Daniel, Midland, Cheese Doodle and Pepsi Cola model of agriculture, to the arrangements for heating our homes and lighting our cities, will begin to wobble. Some of these things will fail us and begin to change our lives. At the same time, we will be tempted to join a worldwide scramble for the world's remaining oil, most of which belongs to countries whose people don't like us. And the nature of this contest may be very violent. Our suburbs will prove to be a huge liability. They represent the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. The project of suburbia represents a set of tragic choices because it is a living arrangement with no future. And that future is now here in the form of the peak oil predicament. Because they have no future, our suburbs entail a powerful psychology of previous investment that will prevent us from even thinking about reforming them or letting them go. That's why Vice President Cheney said the American way of life is non-negotiable. There will be a great battle to preserve the supposed entitlements to suburbia, and it will be an epochal act of futility, a huge waste of effort and of resources that might have been much better spent in finding new ways to carry on an American civilization. We might, for instance, have invested in restoring our national railroad system, which we will need desperately, because no other project we might undertake would have such a profoundly positive impact on our oil consumption. I'm fond of telling audiences, because it's true, that we have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. But instead of restoring it and fixing it, we will desperately try to make cars that get better mileage so we can continue being car dependent and continue building out and elaborating the infrastructure for a living arrangement with no future. The subdivisions of the mech houses, the strip malls, the big box pods, the deployments of hamburger shacks and pizza huts, the whole tragic, nauseating landscape of the world's highest standard of living. And I need to point out, too, that the effort to address our energy problem by such environmental groups as the Rocky Mountain Institute has been precisely the one I've just described, an attempt to create a hypercar, a car that will get supernaturally wonderful mileage. And this is a program coming from our leaders in the environmental movement. And it's not good enough. It's not good enough, because the chief consequence of that project will be to support the idea that we can continue being a car-dependent society. In the service of defending suburbia, the American public may turn to political maniacs who will promise to make the country just like it was back in 1997, before we started having all these problems. In the course of this long emergency we face, life and politics are apt to become profoundly local. Many of my friends wring their hands over George W. Bush, whom they regard as the second coming of Adolf Hitler, and who think the federal government will try to regulate every inch of their lives. I tell them, in the long emergency, the federal government will be impotent and ineffectual, just as it was after Hurricane Katrina, and that the federal government will be lucky if it can answer the phones 5 years from now, let alone regulate your lives. I tell them life in America is going to become profoundly and intensely local, and it will be the local politicians that you will have to worry about. American life will become intensely and profoundly local because the complex systems that hold this nation together are going to fail. We will have to grow more of our own food in the regions where we live. That will not be easy. A lot of our best agricultural land, close to our towns and cities, has been paved over already. And a lot of knowledge has already been lost and will be very difficult to get back. We are going to have to reconstruct local economies, local complex networks of interdependency. And that will not be easy, given the methodical destruction of economic infrastructure to our communities by Walmart and the rest of the national chain companies over the past 40 years. And that, by the way, was a circumstance that the people of America welcomed with open arms. So every time I hear somebody complaining about the depredations of a chain store in their town, I feel compelled to remind them that it was the people in your town who asked for it and wanted it, and that the law of perverse outcomes is always in force, that people don't get what they expect, but they get what they deserve. I'm sorry, it makes me very angry to even think about it, because I cover a lot of territory in this country, and I've seen what's happened to the towns and cities of America. And we have a country now, if you go around this country, you'll see a country that looks like a former Soviet republic. Go to Elmira, New York, and Utica, New York, and Hudson Falls, and Glens Falls, and Fort Edward, and see what has become of those towns, thanks to the national chains. As these severe challenges arise, different regions of the United States will cope differently. The Sun Belt will probably suffer in equal proportion to the degree that it benefited from the cheap oil fiesta of the past several decades, because it squandered its wealth in building gigantic suburban metroplexes that have no future. Atlanta, Dallas, Orlando, Charlotte. The people in these places will be full of grievance and bewilderment, and they may seek comfort in the romance of firearms in seeking to defend the indefensible entitlements of suburbia, of their failing suburbia. The people in Phoenix and Tucson will have dreadful problems with water, on top of their problems with oil, and on top of their problems with the loss of cheap air conditioning. They may not be able to grow any food of their own locally. In Las Vegas, the excitement will finally be over. The capital of a something-for-nothing culture will be left to the wind, the tarantulas, and the Gila monsters, and perhaps Steve Wynn for company. California, the most tragic part of our country, because it was once the most beautiful and is now the most lost, will have many of the previously mentioned problems and the prospect of awful ethnic conflict. I am describing a nation that may not hold together into the 21st century. I would like to be wrong about this, but it is hard to look at the big picture and come up with a different set of conclusions. All parts of the United States are going to endure hardships in the decades ahead. But some regions and some states may be better prepared or just more fortunate. I tend to be more optimistic about the future in New England, in the mid-Atlantic states, in the upper Midwest, and even the Pacific Northwest, if it can escape the wrath emanating out of California. I include Vermont in this list, of course. This part of the country enjoys some advantages. An armature of towns scaled to the requirements of life in a lower energy world. A lot of good agricultural land, much of it underutilized. A civic tradition of responsible local governance. A set of regional collective character traits we associate with New England Yankees at their best: rectitude, discipline, perseverance, and allegiance to community. I am personally not an advocate of national breakup or secession. I grew up in the United States, and I have been, until recently, pretty comfortable with the idea that we would stick together no matter what. But in the long emergency, all bets are off for politics, economics, and social cohesion. Turbulence will be the rule, and we will have to do our best to make sure that the just prevail over the wicked, and that the weak are not trampled, and that the best that was in us as a people can somehow be rescued from the dumpster of memory. Anyway, I'm a New Yorker, an upstater, and I don't relish the idea of patrolling the waters of Lake Champlain in a solar electric gunboat to keep you Green Mountain boys and girls from chopping down the Adirondacks so you can bake all that granola you are reputed to subsist on. However things turn out, I hope you will let me across the border from time to time to see how things are going. I thank you very much for your attention, and I wish you good luck in figuring all this out. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. You're very gracious to a citizen of the Empire State. Thomas has asked me to entertain some questions, and so I will be happy to do that for a while. And I will depend on Thomas to tell me when we've had enough of it. So if anybody wants to ask me a question, I'm at your disposal.
What suggestions do you have for communities to relocalize their economies?
Well, I think most the question is, what suggestions do I have for local communities to prepare for what we're facing? And I really don't have any complicated or perhaps even wise answers for you, except to say that it seems to me that the answers are pretty self-evident. Prepare to grow a lot of your food locally. Prepare to rebuild your towns. Reform your zoning codes. You know, I wrote three previous books about the fiasco of suburbia. And one of the great problems associated with that is that your laws and your codes generally mandate a very unhappy outcome in all of the building and developing that happens. I would have to hasten to add that I think we are facing a period of substantial contraction, not of development. I believe that we are near the end of the suburban expansion cycle and at the beginning of a cycle of contraction, and that we are going to have a whole new range of problems associated with that to cope with, including a good deal of infrastructure will have to be either reused, salvaged, or let go of. I doubt, given the elaborate Byzantine character that they have assumed, I doubt that our codes, including our building codes, are going to even be followed or enforced 10 or 20 years from now, because we will not be able to afford to do that. We won't be able to afford to put elevators when we retrofit every three-story building in Vermont or New York or, for that matter, anywhere else in America. We're going to need a whole new template for how we're going to manage the way we deploy ourselves on the terrain. And I don't want to rattle on at the mouth about this, but one more thing. You know, for about 50 years, our rural land has been valued mainly for its suburban development value. There's going to be a long and painful hangover from that, even though it will be obvious to many of us that we are going to have to make that leap and adjust our worldviews to this new set of circumstances and value our land differently so that we can assign new values to it and perhaps even regulate the future allocation of it. There's going to be a hangover of belief and hoping and wishing that the orgy of suburban development will return. And so people are going to sit there waiting for it to come back and expect that to happen. But sooner or later, we're going to have to change our mindset about the rural land outside of our towns. This, of course, implies that we're going to have to rethink the nature of a human ecology, namely the traditional human ecologies of towns, cities, villages, and agricultural land. Behind this fiasco of suburbia was a very broad and deep national impulse and an idea that was really lodged on our national hard drive, which was that the country and country living would be the antidote to all the failures of the industrial town and city. And that mutated over a long period of decades into the idea that everybody could lead an urban life in the rural setting. That was the paradox of suburbia. And in fact, it's very much the paradox that many Vermonters find themselves in, as they have made that choice during the 1970s and 80s and 90s to build a non-agricultural house in a cornfield in a meadow. And I just want to emphasize that in the future, there's going to be a much clearer distinction, as there once was, in our collective intelligence. A much clearer distinction between what is rural land and what is not rural land, what is the town and what is the country. And people who decide to live in the country 5, 10, 20 years from now are going to probably have to think about following rural life ways and not indulge in the fantasy of being able to live an urban life in the rural setting. That's going to be over. So those are some of the things that I think we ought to prepare for. And it's not a laundry list. It doesn't, you know, don't go out and buy a shotgun, 400 pounds of corn, a pallet load of meals ready to eat, you know, or any of that nonsense. But there you have it.
An audience member suggested screening The End of Suburbia for one's local elected officials.
The gentleman said that we should take copies of the movie The End of Suburbia, a documentary that I run my mouth in, and show it to our local officials so they will not make bad decisions in the future. Well, it's okay with me. I would remind you, though, that our officials have made an almost our officials have made a very impressive 50-year run of almost uniformly bad decisions. And I think that they will continue to make them for quite a while. And they will continue to make them to a large extent because the public will demand it, because the public is still very confused about, especially about these issues of land development and how we occupy the terrain. You know, there's a great deal of confusion, for example, about well, let me give you an example. We hear the term green space and open space all throughout the region, and that is thought to be the universal remedy for all the ills of our towns. Have you got a problem with your town? Put green space there. Put open space there. Well, I urge all of you to remove those terms from your vocabularies because they are abstractions and they're meaningless, for one thing. Many of our towns don't suffer from too little open space. They suffer from too much poorly closed space. The fabric of our towns is not intimate enough. We define space poorly with our buildings. Most of our so-called green space and open space is ambiguous. When you use a term like green space, you make no distinction between the land between the off-ramp of the interstate highway and somebody's farm or even a park in your town. So one of the things I urge you to do is, if you want a park, ask for a park. Don't ask for abstractions. If you ask for an abstraction will be delivered. And that's what we've gotten. We've gotten 10,000 berms with juniper shrubs all over the Northeast to act as buffers between the Kmart and the Walmart. And all that green space is doing nothing for you. But of course, you know, when you're faced with the task now, the new task of really having to define what an urban human ecology is at all scales, the village, the hamlet, the town, even the city, that nomenclature and that vocabulary is going to have to become clearer because you'll have to know what you're talking about from now on. And of course, this only pertains to the town planning issues. Way in the back, ma'am.
What is the reaction to what you've been writing, and who is listening to you?
Well, various people are listening. It's mostly, you know, from the bottom up. You know, there's a reason that we're getting such poor leadership on these issues from the highest levels. And I, you know, one explanation for it is the economic explanation. The dirty secret of the American economy is that it is not about making things, and it's not about information. It's about the creation of suburban sprawl and suburban infrastructure and all of the accessories and furnishings of it and all of the activities associated with it, like real estate sales and the magical manufacturing of mortgages, which are given to people with no record of ever paying back a loan, the debts which are then converted into tradable instruments and sent up the food chain of finance. If you subtract those activities from our economy, there isn't a whole lot left besides hair cutting, fried chicken, and open heart surgery. So neither George Bush or John Kerry, characterized by Kevin Phillips as a haircut in search of a brain. So neither John Kerry or George Bush would tell the American people the truth, which is we can not only not continue to have a living arrangement with no future, but we cannot continue to have an economy based on the creation of ever more of a living arrangement with no future. And so that, I think, is why we're not hearing that from the highest levels. Now, you know, how this information is filtering up is hard to say. There are a couple of other just terms that might avail, you know, to explain this. One is cognitive dissonance, you know, that the mental static in our collective imagination, which confounds our ability to have a coherent discussion about this at the in the public sphere. Another term I like is the term consensus trance. Consensus trance. I think that's a pretty self-explanatory term, but it's a good one, and it's not mine. It came from Eric Davis, who got it from a professor at the University of California. There's also the term outside context problem. It is a set of issues and problems so far beyond the realm of the boundaries of our normal experience that we can't imagine having to get along without cheese doodles, Subarus, or the interstate highway system, or Walt Disney World, or Walmart, or any of the things that are the common touchstones of everyday life in America. We cannot imagine life without them. We cannot imagine their failure, despite the fact that they're going to fail. They're not going to disappoint us. They're going to fail very predictably. So it's hard to answer that question, but that's my explanation. Let me just say something. This is a famous public deliberative session, and I want you all to learn a new skill that you're going to need in the long emergency, which is public speaking. And what it means is you have to make yourself heard to everybody in the room, not just me up here. So talk to everybody loudly.
Steve Schultz, a high school teacher, said school curriculum is based on a 1950s model of energy and a late 20th century economy. The curriculum should reflect present realities, but administrators don't want to hear it.
Well, then you have to scare them even more by being determined to teach it. I wasn't taught this either. In fact, of all things, I was a theater major. Can you imagine anything more useless? Does that mean I have to stop? Oh, you were? Oh, are you the puppet guy? Oh, yeah. My homie. You know, you're just going to have to be more determined. You're going to have to summon up that good old Yankee trait and persevere in the face of all the opprobrium and disapproval and negative reinforcement that you run into. And be polite about it and be determined and keep doing it.
Is your vision of the future based on running out of petroleum?
No, it's not that we're going to run out of petroleum, but we are going to get into trouble as we begin down the arc of depletion. We don't have to run out to start having problems. All we have to do is cross the arc of maximum global production, and we're going to be in trouble.
If we use resources such as coal and alternative energy, can't we continue our suburban lifestyle?
The question really is, what about all the alternatives to oil, including coal, and other things we can do? We are going to do everything that we possibly can to run our country and to run as much of it as we have been accustomed to running. But no combination of alternative fuels is going to allow us to run the United States the way we're running it now, or even a substantial fraction of it. We are not going to run Walt Disney World, the interstate highway system, and Walmart on solar, wind, nuclear, coal, hydrogen, methane hydrates, zero-point energy, wishful thinking, or any other possible combination. We are going to have to make other arrangements. And, you know, often when I go around to colleges, and I speak to impressionable young people, they're very disappointed that I'm not a salesman of panaceas. They are very interested in having a sovereign remedy for all the problems that we are encountering. And there really is none. But there is a set of intelligent responses to what we face. And they involve making other arrangements, and chiefly downscaling and downsizing and resizing and right-sizing and reorganizing all of the activities of normal life, growing our food, running commerce and trade, running school systems, deciding how we're going to occupy the terrain of the United States, meaning, you know, whether we're going to live in towns or in the rural places. So that's the intelligent response, not to try to invent a car that gets 111 miles per gallon, because you know what? If you even succeeded at that, we would just have another 15 years of debate in the select boards of Vermont about building new parking structures and throwing away your resources and your public money on more infrastructure to accommodate the car. So we're going to have to make other arrangements. What do I think about the secession issue and related political responses? It interests me as a phenomenon. I would make similar observations about it as I may have made about the new urbanist movement, which I was a part of for the last 15 years, because they had the most intelligent response to the suburban juggernaut. And their response was the retrieval of lost information from the dumpster of history for how to build traditional human ecologies. And in a way, it seemed to me even at the time that the new urbanists had a precognition that something was in the air, that something was up, that there was a set of problems out there that we were going to have to face. And they didn't articulate it that way, but they came up with a brilliant program for helping the people of the United States find an alternative to the suicidal suburban development enterprise that they were engaged in. And so I would think that the secession movement in this room is similar in the sense that it is a precognition of events that are coming down at us, which are going to, which as we begin to live more intensely locally, is going to create much greater distinctions between the different regions of the country, where they have been very unified over the last 50 years because of things like mass communications, the reliability of the electric grid, the ubiquity of the automobile, and all of the services required to use it all over the country. The tremendous, tumultuous movement of people from one state and one city to another looking for other opportunities. And that was all possible during the glory days of the cheap energy blowout. But as that starts to wane and we live more intensely, there are going to be big differences between the people in Vermont and the people in Phoenix. And they're not necessarily going to be reconcilable. And particularly, once again, between the people in the North and the people in the South. You know, as I said in my book, you know, one of the things that there's some characteristics about Sunbelt behavior that are kind of unappetizing to think about. You know, the fact that the NASCAR fans who make up the middle class of the South, and it's not a fable or an urban legend, that they really are a real group of people. You know, they sort of crawled out of the mud about 23 years ago and entered the middle class, and they have a very limited experience with being civilized people. And their tendency is going to be to revert to what I call the latent encoded behavior of their culture, which includes the romance of firearms and the belief that firearms should be used liberally in the defense of hyper-individualism, a hyper-individualism which, by the way, exists at the expense of the common good and the public interest and the community and all the things that you have a long-standing acquaintance with here because you did not crawl out of the mud 23 years ago. And these differences are going to become more apparent. And in the other parts of the country, you're also going to see a collision between the doctrines of hyper-individualism as the highest value and evangelical Christianity. And those things are going to cause problems and friction, along with the firearms. So I think we can expect a fairly turbulent century ahead. Plaid shirt.
Organizations like the Rocky Mountain Institute are focusing on technological solutions. Do we need new institutions in order to address our problems?
Well, what you're describing is a gross infatuation with the hardware of our society and with technology in particular. And, you know, I saw this in my encounter with the people at Google, the Google company. I was in San Francisco in June. And when you come to San Francisco and you are the author of a book, the people at Google kidnap you, take you up to their headquarters, and ask you to talk to them. So I talked to a large room full of Googlers, as large as this room. It was an interesting experience because they were, in some manner or other, the best representatives of the highest technological levels of our young generation. Many of them were millionaires and very accomplished technologists. Oddly enough, they all dressed like skateboard rats, which told me something about the infantilization of our culture. But, you know, I gave my talk and made my pitch, and when it was over, one after another got up and said, in effect, dude, we have, like, technology. And that is coming from the highest level of industry and technology. And it's unfortunate for a number of reasons. For one thing, it illustrates a profound and troubling trend in our culture, which is that we are succumbing to many delusional ideas. And that particular one is the idea that technology is exactly the same as energy, and that the two are interchangeable and substitutable. And it's a fundamental delusion, and it's unfortunate that they believe that. You know, I saw another illustration of it at Middlebury about 4 months ago. I gave a talk there, and some of the students were very incensed about what I said, because I discounted some of their wishes that we would run the interstate highway system in Walt Disney World on biodiesel. And, after it was all over, I started to ask them about it. And I said to them, if we lose our ability to continue pouring oil and natural gas-based fertilizers and other inputs on the soil to produce all those cheese doodles and all that Pepsi-Cola, and our crop yields will probably go down, probably way down, we're going to probably have to devote more of our cropland to raising food for people, not raising beans and hemp to make fuel for our cars. And they said, oh, dude. You know, I suggested to them, we may need more animal traction in farming in the future. And I don't know what percentage that is. Maybe it'll be as little as 4% more. Maybe it'll be 200% more. Maybe it'll be something in between. But we're going to be running some of that stuff. We're going to be running animals. And they need a lot of cropland devoted to raising their feeds. Has that occurred to you, biodiesel enthusiasts? And they said, oh, dude. So the delusional thing, and they were very well-educated, earnest, hopeful young people, and I don't like to disappoint them or dash their hopes, but we need a better quality of thinking about these things. So again, it's not going to be so much about finding new ways to run our cars. It's going to be about making comprehensively new arrangements for all of our stuff. Do we have time for more of this?
One more.
One more. Okay. The lady in the cranberry turtleneck.
The questioner refers to reading an article about solutions used by the country of Cuba.
Yeah, that was a famous article by Bill McKibben in Harper's Magazine. Bill McKibben, a Vermont resident who lives down in Middlebury, a friend to us all. Yes, he described the convulsion that Cuba went through when it lost its Soviet subsidies and it no longer got free, cheap oil, free, cheap, natural gas-based fertilizers and parts for their tractors and machines. And what Fidel Castro did was undertake a rapid and comprehensive reform of Cuban agriculture and dismantled the collective farms, rearranged them and reorganized them so that they became small farms again, run by individuals, and began a very robust program of using oxen instead of tractors to farm the land. The Cuban calorie intake per person went down from 2,500 calories a day to about 1,700 calories a day. So they paid a substantial price in their personal lives and perhaps even in their life expectancies, but perhaps not. You know, there's evidence that actually people live longer if they eat a little bit less. In any case, it was a good thing for them. But I would remind you, just so that we don't over-sentimentalize things like this, that the experience of Cuba in the last 10 years occurred against the background of a world that was still pretty much intact, pretty much chugging along in the background, and that the events that we face in this long emergency will take place against the background of a world in turmoil. Those are very different things, and I wish you all the best of luck, and I'll see you again when you get your program up and running. Thank you.
That was James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, speaking on October 28th at the first statewide convention on Vermont secession in Montpelier, Vermont.
Good afternoon. How's everybody? And I have to say that I think we need another round of applause, because only in Vermont could you get the State House to sponsor a secession convention for $35. Come on now. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Here to discuss a new group called Free Vermont, let me introduce Lindsay Johnson and Skylar Bailey.
Thanks, Rob. My name is Lindsay Johnson. I am a native Vermonter, and for 20 years, I have watched as my homeland is slowly swallowed by urban sprawl, economic hardship, loss of civil liberties, and other devastating aspects of Americana. To let this continue is to willingly hand over this land and forget the history and the culture behind it. It's time that we stop claiming dependence upon those who stand in the way of our liberty. Many have already realized that declaring independence from the United States is the righteous thing to do, but feel helpless, alone, or unable to make a contribution to the cause. We are here to present a new movement that will try to utilize all available popular support for Vermont independence. A movement based on the positive aspects of the sort of change that we're suggesting, that focuses on what's good for Vermont, rather than what's wrong with the United States, that takes and holds positions on political issues important to Vermont, and most importantly, that provides a solid, attainable vision for what an independent Vermont would look like, sound like, feel like, a working model for a new future. Skylar.
Free Vermont seeks to create and maintain largely autonomous chapters in every town. These chapters would, to a large extent, decide what local issues they wanted to talk about, discuss, take action on. They would hold their own events and make connections with other towns to hold events that were beneficial to varieties of chapters. Each town chapter would serve as sort of a functioning model for a local government. Imagine going to town meeting and be able to vote on such things as taxation, or there's things more important than, you know, how many school buses you need this year. In America, we have what people like to call a representative democracy. What we're talking about is a self-representative democracy, which runs sort of the same way, except you're your own congressman and you actually get to cast a vote. One of the, to me, most important things about this would be to write a constitution that would be what the end goal would be. To say right up front, this is the type of independence that we're looking for. Each town would then get to look at this sort of draft constitution, toss it around, make suggestions, make changes, just to get these ideas talked about and on the floor. We're talking about a movement with life, a movement with feet, a movement that's cool. Music events, entertainment style events. Events that would foster Vermont pride and a knowledge of Vermont history. We are here from the Middlebury chapter. If you'd like to join the Montpelier chapter, you can talk to Ben Matchstick. If you'd like to start your own chapter, you can come speak to one of us or go do it. That's about all. If you're at all interested, my phone number is 425-3104. I'm a Leo.
The convention was sponsored by the Second Vermont Republic. To find out more, visit vermontrepublic.org. We'll have more from the convention on next week's show. You can download an MP3 of this and previous programs at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by a